Chapter 13. It was past 4 o'clock before I left the house, together with Mills. Mr. Blunt, still in his riding costume, escorted us to the very door. He asked us to send him the first fiacre we met on our way to town. "'Tis impossible to walk in this get-up through the streets," he remarked, with his brilliant smile. At this point I propose to transcribe some notes I made at the time in little black books which I have hunted up in the litter of the past. Very cheap, common little notebooks that by the lapse of years have acquired a touching dimness of aspect, the frayed, worn-out dignity of documents. Expression on paper has never been my forte. My life had been a thing of outward manifestations. I never had been secret, or even systematically taciturn about my simple occupations which might have been foolish, but had never required either caution or mystery. But in those 4 hours since midday a complete change had come over me. For good or evil I left that house committed to an enterprise that could not be talked about, which would have appeared to many senseless and perhaps ridiculous, but was certainly full of risks, and, apart from that, commanded discretion on the ground of simple loyalty. It would not only close my lips, but it would to a certain extent cut me off from my usual haunts, and from the society of my friends, especially of the light-hearted, young, harum-scarum kind. This was unavoidable. It was because I felt myself thrown back upon my own thoughts, and forbidden to seek relief amongst other lives it was perhaps only for that reason at first I started an irregular, fragmentary record of my days. I made these notes, not so much to preserve the memory one cared not for any tomorrow then, but to help me to keep a better hold of the actuality. I scribbled them on shore, and I scribbled them on the sea. And in both cases they are concerned, not only with the nature of the facts, but with the intensity of my sensations. It may be, too, that I learned to love the sea for itself only at that time. Woman and the sea revealed themselves to me together, as it were. Two mistresses of life's values. The illimitable greatness of the one, the unfathomable seduction of the other working their immemorial spells from generation to generation, fell upon my heart at last. A common fortune, an unforgettable memory of the sea's formless might, and of the sovereign charm in that woman's form wherein there seemed to beat the pulse of divinity rather than blood. I begin here with the notes written at the end of that very day. Parted with Mills on the quay. We had walked side by side in absolute silence. The fact is he is too old for me to talk to him freely. For all his sympathy and seriousness I don't know what note to strike, and I am not at all certain what he thinks of all this. As we shook hands at parting, I asked him how much longer he expected to stay. And he answered me that it depended on Archie was making arrangements for him to cross the frontier. He wanted to see the very ground on which the principle of legitimacy was actually asserting itself arms in hand. It sounded to my positive mind the most fantastic thing in the world, this elimination of personalities from what seemed but the merest political dynastic adventure. So it wasn't Dona Rita, it wasn't Blunt, it wasn't the pretender with his big infectious laugh, it wasn't all that lot of politicians, archbishops, and generals, of monks, guerrilleros, and smugglers by sea and land, of dubious agents and shady speculators and undoubted swindlers, who were pushing their fortunes at the risk of their precious skins. No. It was the legitimist principle asserting itself. Well, I would accept the view, but with one reservation. All the others might have been merged into the idea, but I, the latest recruit, I would not be merged in the legitimist principle. Mine was an act of independent assertion. Never before had I felt so intensely aware of my personality. But I said nothing of that to Mills. I only told him I thought we had better not be seen very often together in the streets. He agreed. Hearty handshake. Looked affectionately after his broad back. It never occurred to him to turn his head. What was I in comparison with the principle of legitimacy? Late that night I went in search of Dominic. That Mediterranean sailor was just the man I wanted. He had a great experience of all unlawful things that can be done on the seas, and he brought to the practice of them much wisdom and audacity. That I didn't know where he lived was nothing, since I knew where he loved. The proprietor of a small, quiet cafe on the quay, a certain Madame Leonor, a woman of 35 with an open Roman face and intelligent black eyes, had captivated his heart years ago. In that cafe, with our heads close together over a marble table, Dominic and I held an earnest and endless confabulation, while Madame Leonor, rustling a black silk skirt, with gold earrings, with her raven hair elaborately dressed, and something nonchalant in her movements, would take occasion, in passing to and fro, to rest her hand for a moment on Dominic's shoulder. Later, when the little cafe had emptied itself of its habitual customers, mostly people connected with the work of ships and cargoes, she came quietly to sit at our table, and looking at me very hard with her black, sparkling eyes, asked Dominic familiarly what had happened to his signorino. It was her name for me. I was Dominic's signorino. She knew me by no other, and our connection has always been somewhat of a riddle to her. She said that I was somehow changed since she saw me last. In her rich voice, she urged Dominic only to look at my eyes. I must have had some piece of luck come to me, either in love or at cards, she bantered. But Dominic answered half in scorn that I was not of the sort that runs after that kind of luck. He stated generally that there were some young gentlemen very clever in inventing new ways of getting rid of their time and their money. However, if they needed a sensible man to help them, he had no objection himself to lend a hand. Dominic's general scorn for the beliefs and activities and abilities of upper-class people covered the principle of legitimacy amply, but he could not resist the opportunity to exercise his special faculties in a field he knew of old. He had been a desperate smuggler in his younger days. We settled the purchase of a fast-sailing craft, agreed that it must be a balancelle, and something altogether out of the common. He knew of one suitable, but she was in Corsica. Offered to start for Bastia by mail boat in the morning. All the time the handsome and mature Madame Leonor sat by, smiling faintly, amused at her great man joining like this in a frolic of boys. She said the last words of that evening, "Ooh, men never grow up," touching lightly the gray hair above his temple. A fortnight later, ... in the afternoon to the Prado. Beautiful day. At the moment of ringing at the door, a strong emotion of an anxious kind. Why? Down the length of the dining room in the rotund part full of afternoon light, Donna R., sitting cross-legged on the divan in the attitude of a very old idol, or a very young child, and surrounded by many cushions, waves her hand from afar pleasantly surprised, exclaiming, "Hat! Back already!" I give her all the details, and we talk for 2 hours across a large brass bowl containing a little water placed between us, lighting cigarettes and dropping them, innumerable, puffed at, yet untasted, in the overwhelming interest of the conversation. Found her very quick in taking the points, and very intelligent in her suggestions. All formality soon vanished between us, and before very long I discovered myself sitting cross-legged too, while I held forth on the qualities of different Mediterranean sailing craft, and on the romantic qualifications of Dominic for the task. I believe I gave her the whole history of the man, mentioning even the existence of Madame Leonor, since the little cafe would have to be the headquarters of the marine part of the plot. She murmured, "Ah, une belle romaine," thoughtfully. She told me that she liked to hear people of that sort spoken of in terms of our common humanity. She observed also that she wished to see Dominic someday, to set her eyes for once on a man who could be absolutely depended on. She wanted to know whether he had engaged himself in this adventure solely for my sake. I said that no doubt it was partly that. We had been very close associates in the West Indies from where we had returned together, and he had a notion that I could be depended on to. but mainly, I suppose, it was from taste. And there was in him also a fine carelessness as to what he did, and a love of venturesome enterprise. And you, she said, is it carelessness too? In a measure, I said, if in limits. And very soon you will get tired. When I do, I will tell you. But I may also get frightened. I suppose you know there are risks, I mean apart from the risk of life. As for instance, she said, for instance, being captured, tried, and sentenced to what they call the galleys, apostrophe in Ceuta. And all this from that love for. Dot, not for legitimacy, I interrupted the inquiry lightly. But what's the use asking such questions? It's like asking the veiled figure of fate. It doesn't know its own mind nor its own heart. It has no heart. But what if I were to start asking you who have a heart, and are not veiled to my sight? She dropped her charming adolescent head, so firm in modeling, so gentle in expression. Her uncovered neck was round like the shaft of a column. She wore the same wrapper of thick blue silk. At that time she seemed to live either in her riding habit or in that wrapper folded tightly round her, and open low to a point in front. Because of the absence of all trimming round the neck, and from the deep view of her bare arms in the white sleeve, this garment seemed to be put directly on her skin, and gave one the impression of one's nearness to her body which would have been troubling, but for the perfect unconsciousness of her manner. That day she carried no barbarous arrow in her hair. It was parted on one side, brushed back severely, and tied with a black ribbon, without any bronze mist about her forehead or temple. This smoothness added to the many varieties of her expression also that of childlike innocence. Great progress in our intimacy brought about unconsciously by our enthusiastic interest in the matter of our discourse, and, in the moments of silence, by the sympathetic current of our thoughts. And this rapidly growing familiarity, truly, as he had a terrible gift for it, had all the varieties of earnestness. Serious, excited, ardent, and even gay. She laughed in contralto, but her laugh was never very long, and when it had ceased, the silence of the room with the light dying in all its many windows seemed to lie about me warm by its vibration. As I was preparing to take my leave after a longish pause into which we had fallen as into a vague dream, she came out of it with a start and a quiet sigh. She said, I had forgotten myself. I took her hand, and was raising it naturally, without premeditation, when I felt suddenly the arm to which it belonged become insensible, passive, like a stuffed limb, and the whole woman go inanimate all over. Brusquely I dropped the hand before it reached my lips, and it was so lifeless that it fell heavily onto the divan. I remained standing before her. She raised to me not her eyes but her whole face, inquisitively perhaps in appeal. No, this isn't good enough for me, I said. The last of the light gleamed in her long enigmatic eyes, as if they were precious enamel in that shadowy head which in its immobility suggested a creation of a distant past. Immortal art, not transient life. Her voice had a profound quietness. She excused herself. It's only habit, or instinct, or what you like. I have had to practice that in self-defense lest I should be tempted sometimes to cut the arm off. I remembered the way as he had abandoned this very arm and hand to the white-haired ruffian. It rendered me gloomy and idiotically obstinate. Very ingenious. But this sort of thing is of no use to me, I declared. Make it up, suggested her mysterious voice, while her shadowy figure remained unmoved, indifferent amongst the cushions. I didn't stir either. I refused in the same low tone. No. Not before you give it to me yourself someday. Yes, someday, she repeated in a breath in which there was no irony but rather hesitation, reluctance. What did I know? I walked away from the house in a curious state of gloomy satisfaction with myself. And this is the last extract. A month afterwards. This afternoon going up to the villa I was for the first time accompanied in my way by some misgivings. Tomorrow I sail. first trip and therefore in the nature of a trial trip, and I can't overcome a certain gnawing emotion, for it is a trip that mustn't fail. In that sort of enterprise there is no room for mistakes. Of all the individuals engaged in it, will everyone be intelligent enough, faithful enough, bold enough? Looking upon them as a whole it seems impossible, but as each has got only a limited part to play, they may be found sufficient each for his particular trust. And will they be all punctual, I wonder? An enterprise that hangs on the punctuality of many people, no matter how well disposed and even heroic, hangs on a thread. This I have perceived to be also the greatest of Dominic's concerns. He too wonders. And when he breathes his doubts, the smile lurking under the dark curl of his mustaches is not reassuring. But there is also something exciting in such speculations, and the road to the villa seemed to me shorter than ever before. Let in by the silent, ever active, dark lady's maid, who is always on the spot, and always on the way somewhere else, opening the door with one hand, while she passes on, turning on one for a moment her quick, black eyes, which just miss being lustrous, as if someone had breathed on them lightly. On entering the long room I perceive Mills established in an armchair which he had dragged in front of the divan. I do the same to another, and there we sit side by side facing our tenderly amiable yet somehow distant among her cushions, with an immemorial seriousness in her long, shaded eyes and her fugitive smile hovering about, but never settling on her lips. Mills, who is just back from over the frontier, must have been asking R whether she had been worried again by her devoted friend with the white hair. At least I concluded so, because I found them talking of the heartbroken Azalotti. And after having answered their greetings I sit and listen to Rita addressing Mills earnestly. No, I assure you Azalotti had done nothing to me. I knew him. He was a frequent visitor at the pavilion, though I, personally, never talked with him very much in Henry Alliger's lifetime. Other men were more interesting, and he himself was rather reserved in his manner to me. He was an international politician and financier, a nobody. He, like many others, was admitted only to feed and amuse Henry Alliger's scorn of the world, which was insatiable, I tell you. Yes, said Mills. Can imagine. But I know. Often when we were alone Henry Alliger used to pour Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.